Magic,
and the world of illusion.
Magic TV
and Craig Petty proudly present the Talk Magic Podcast. Every week we bring you awesome interviews with the greatest magicians that have ever lived. And now, here's your host, Craig Petty.
Welcome back to Magic TV. My name's Craig. It is 9 o'clock, which means it's time for an interview. Now, today, I'm super excited. This is somebody I've had so much respect for. He is, I don't think I'm downplaying this at all by saying he's one of the, if not the leading touring illusion acts in the world. He has been there. He has done that. He's bought the t-shirt. He innovates. He creates. He develops. He's an incredible performer. He's an inspiration to many, many artists all over the world. And he's so busy. I don't think many people perform as much as this gentleman. I've been trying to get an interview with him for months now, but he's normally somewhere in a different country performing or consulting or doing something. So it's a huge honor to have him on the channel. I am, of course, talking about the legend himself, Jamie Allen. How are you doing, Jamie?
I'm very well, Craig. Thank you very much for that introduction. It's very flattering.
It's true, though. I mean, yeah. You know, you have done so much, and it's not like you're long in the tooth and you're retiring, but if you took a snapshot of where you are right now and you said to almost any magician in the world, you know, if you ended your career and you'd done what Jamie had done up until this point, would you be happy? They would go, I'd be over the moon. And yet you've done all of that, and you've only just got started. I know how many other plans you've got. It's incredible.
You know, it's interesting you say that, because I often, I mean, we'll probably touch on it, but I remember when I finally got my show in Chicago, that was when I said, I'm happy now. You know, everything that I've done, if it all stopped today, I could say that I kind of did what I wanted to do, that, you know, when I was a little boy. So yeah, it is nice, but it's unfortunately, it's kind of an addiction, and you just can't stop, because you know what it's like in our business. We love it. You know, it's not really about money. And with me, it's never been about fame. It's just been about this want to just keep doing new work as best as I'm able anyway.
So you know, that's kind of like an ambition thing. You know, I think one of the reasons maybe that you've got to where you are is because you are so ambitious. You're like, right, okay, a lot of people do rest on their laurels, but you get there and you're like, right, okay, so I've done this, what's next?
Yeah, it is a bit like that. I mean, I certainly can't help it, and it's much to the detriment of those around me sometimes. You know, I try to find time for myself now, but yeah, there's always something. Like, we have had a couple of months in the summertime when I've just been working, and I purposefully didn't take on anything new, because I knew that we're about to embark on a tour now in the US, which is going to start in November. And we've got a new show, because we've been running our show iMagician for a decade, actually. So we're doing a version of iMagician for the first few shows, but then we're transitioning into a new show that's going out. And that's taking up all my time at the moment.
I definitely want to talk about that. But for anybody who hasn't heard about you, which I very much doubt there's many people that are watching this that haven't.
Well, there'll be somebody, I'm sure.
Well, let's give them a frame of reference. Let's start at the very beginning. How did you get into magic, Jamie? Where did that all begin? What was your origin story?
I was lucky, actually, because my parents were in show business, not magicians. My mom was a singer, my father was a songwriter, my uncle was a comedian, my aunties were dancers. So there was kind of a showbiz feel in the family. And when my parents stopped touring, so that I could, they wanted to give me some kind of a normal lifestyle. So they bought a pub, which is, I always joke, is their idea of a normal upbringing. they bought this little pub in the Midlands, and they knocked out the bar and the lounge and put a little tiny theatre inside that held about 180 people, approximately. And we used to have cabaret acts there, and people that will probably remember, you know, back in the day, people like Little and Large and Jim Bowen and people that were at the time on TV, they were friends of my parents, because, of course, my mum and dad knew all of these people from the variety circuit. So they used to do them a favour and come down and do a show in this place. And that's where I did my first show when I was 8. And it was because I got given a magic set, didn't we all, when I was five, a Fisher Price magic set. Actually, it's right here.
Really?
Yeah, look at this. This is actually my old magic set.
Oh, wow.
This is what I got when I was five. I've got it out because it's going to form part of my new show.
Oh, wow.
So it's, but yeah, look, it's got a little jaw box and all these little cool traps and things that move around inside. It's really a fun little thing. And for a kid, it was more of a magic toy than anything.
Mm.
And it had this incredible illusion in it.
Oh, well. Top quality.
Yeah. But that was what got me my start. And I loved it. And then my parents knew a couple of magicians. When they were coming over, I used to hound the magicians. Looking back, I'm sure that they must have either loved it or just hated coming because they knew that this kid was going to come and like stick to them the entire time they were in the venue. But my dad used to say, like, if you've got any magic tricks you can bring for Jamie, if you've got anything you can bring for him. So they used to bring me like a book or a couple of, a couple of old tricks. And I started picking things up from there. And then my big break for me came when I was about nine, when I went to an antique shop. I talk about this in my book. I went to an antique shop in Warwickshire looking for an old top hat with my mom. And the guy said, "We've only got a magician's one." And we said, "That's exactly what we're looking for." And we went into this back room. And in this back room, there was this Aladdin's cave. There was an estate of a magician that had passed away. And all of his act had ended up in this tiny antique shop in the middle of nowhere, in the middle of Warwick.
Oh.
And this is in the days before eBay and before any other means of getting rid of this stuff. So it was just sat there. And my mom managed to do a deal to take pretty much everything out of that shop. So we ended up with all these incredible props and, you know, books that I still have. You know, I learned from this first edition of Modern Magic. It's like I've got my whole life. I keep hold of these things that mean something to us, but yeah, this was the first edition of Modern Magic. And that was one of my first magic books, you know, crazy. And I remember learning the past from here and stuff when I was a kid. And that was like my dream come true. We came home with just so much stuff.
Wow. So what happened? So you're 9 years old. You've just received a bunch of professional quality magic. Where did you go from there? Were you thinking, right, okay, I'm going to put a show together?
Like, yeah, that was exactly it. I did my first show in this venue that my mum and dad owned when I was eight. I say owned, it sounds like, you know, as if we were wealthy or something. We really weren't. I mean, anybody, you know, like yourself that runs a business, you know how difficult it can be, something like that. And it wasn't all plain sailing. They had good times and bad times, and it was never easy, certainly. But we used to do, I used to do a show there sometimes on a Saturday night. I would open about once a month, sometimes every 2 weeks. And I would do about 10 minutes at the top of that show. I remember my first ever show was multiplying balls, equal on equal ropes, and all patter stuff, because that's what I saw. That's what the magicians that were coming in with, those kind of dance floor style. That was how magic was back in that time period in the 80s. And I did a signed note, a note to wallet. And I remember I switched the note. You know, I did the miscall of the numbers. That was the method. And I actually forgot to take the note out of the envelope, and I did, in fact, burn it. And it was a £5 note. It didn't affect the end of the trick, but back in the early 80s, that was quite a considerable amount of money for me to set fire to, because I was just nervous the first time I did it. But as it happened, I didn't even realize that I'd done it until after the trick, because the trick finished, the note's back.
That's amazing. Yeah. That's fantastic. So you're doing shows in this venue. So you're getting flight time right from a very, very early age. At what point did you think, okay, I'm going to do this professionally?
There was never a moment that I didn't think I would do that. It was a very natural step for me.
Parents and their influence?
Yeah. I mean, when I was 8 or 9 or 10, I was doing magic because I loved it. I wasn't particularly at that point thinking about a career, but there was never a moment in my life when I was doing it that I didn't imagine that this is what I was always going to be doing. And I certainly didn't think of it in the context that I'm going to do this for a living. I just figured that's what I was going to do. Because to me, I mean, performing in entertainment, in the entertainment industry, was obviously a way of life for my family. So it didn't in any way seem like an odd job to have. And I had that support. And my parents tried to make sure I got as good an education as possible, but I was never great at school. They found out I was dyslexic when I was maybe 14, 15, when it was still a kind of an unknown term, really. They weren't really looking for it the way they do now. And, you know, I never really did great at school. And I knew that I was smart and that I just wasn't great at these particular assignments, a lot of them. And I think it was definitely a point where I just felt like I wasn't really trying that much anymore. Interestingly, I never ended up sitting my exams. I never sat my GCSEs. I don't have any. And it's because I landed a job as a kind of a red coat at a place called Kiln Park in Tenby in Wales. And I was there for 20 weeks for the summer season. And I was like the room compere of the kids' room. It was great. And I got to do my illusion show there on a Wednesday. And on a Monday and Saturday, I did a spot in the team show. And on a Sunday morning, I would do a show for the kids. So I was doing magic there, which is why I wanted the job. But I had to leave before my exams. And they let me out as work experience and said, you can come back and sit them. And I never have. I often thought that would make an interesting documentary, would be to go back and see how I would do. I should probably call them up and say I want to do it.
That's funny. And did you ever, before we move on, did your parents ever try to move you into other aspects of show business? Because obviously they were singers and songwriters.
No. I mean, I think my mom would have been interested for me to be a musician. I had a drum kit. I was given a drum kit once to see if I was into that, and I was terrible. My dad attempted to teach me the guitar, and it just didn't stick with me. I was very musical. Like I have perfect pitch. Like I can hear if something's a fraction out, and it's very irritating for me if somebody is not quite on. And I understand music, you know, but I can't write it or play it, but I get like the orchestration and I understand how it wants to work. And that's all helped me, certainly theatrically, when I became to start producing shows. I've always understood, you know, the emotion behind it and why it works. But no, they've never tried to push me into anything. I was always a magician and I never imagined I'd do anything else. I tried to branch out into other things as I've gotten older, you know, try my hand at directing, tried my hand at producing, and I still produce shows. But, you know, those things, you know, don't always go your way.
Not at all. And did you ever, you know, when we think about Jamie Allen, anyone who knows you, they think of you as a stage performer, as an illusionist. And, you know, everything that you've said up until this point, hey, you got a chance to go on stage in your parents' venue and, you know, you didn't sit your exams because you were doing your illusion show and you're going on stage. Was there ever a point in time where you were gravitating towards close-up magic? Because you mentioned the past.
Yeah. Yeah, I did. I mean, I did like we all did when I got into the industry. I did anywhere. I worked anywhere that would pay me. I did children's parties, as we probably all did when we started out and carry on to. And a lot of people are still making a killing living at it. I actually enjoyed doing kids' parties, honestly. I used to do close-up. I hated doing close-up. I have such respect for people that can do it. I didn't like walking up to tables. In those days, it wasn't a cool thing either. Do you remember, Craig, when it was back in those early 90s when magic wasn't a cool thing? It was just like... Paul Daniels was the point of reference, and he'd been around for a long time at that point. And there wasn't any cool factor to it whatsoever. And I was getting booked to do these close-up gigs. And I remember I stopped. I was doing one at the De Montfort Hall in Leicester, and I walked up to a table and I said, would you like to see some magic? And the guy said, how much do we have to pay you to F off? And I left. I said, oh, nothing. And I left the building. I went home, and the client phoned me the next day to say, where were you? I didn't get paid. I just left. I said, I just went. I just didn't want to deal with them. And I never did another close-up show after that. That was the last one.
Oh, wow. Wow. And back in, I don't want to say your day and my day, but these days, everybody thinks of close-up magic. It's what you go into. But I remember when I first got into magic, nobody really thought about close-up. It was all, I remember one of the first props I ever bought was a chair suspension. It was like, it was staged. That's what everybody wanted to do back those.
There was hardly any market for close-up magic when I was young. I only went into it because I knew a guy called Mark Cosby, who was doing corporate close-up magic through this agency in Leicester, and he was making great money, and he was one of very few back in those days when you could probably name all of the UK's close-up magicians. There was probably 10 or 15 people that were kind of doing it, but it wasn't, it wasn't a popular thing. It was building at that point.
Yeah, I completely agree with you.
Yeah.
So you, we've got to the point where you've left school. You haven't done your GCSEs. You've gone straight into the industry. You've gone on Park, which is a great experience. What steps did you go to then? Because we've already discussed, you're really ambitious. You obviously wanted goals. You had goals that you wanted to hit, which we know now that you did hit. But did you have a plan? Did you like, right, okay, I'm not.
I did. I did. I did the summer season. I thought, I'm only going to do this 1 year. My next goal was I wanted to become the act. I wanted to become the visiting act that came in. So I went and did a couple of showcases, and I landed a season for Haven Warner the next year, where I was touring cabaret. So then I was working virtually every night of the week. And that's, I knew I needed flight time with an act. And that's what I did for about 3 years. That's when I was running around, and I got into the Pontin circuit because I knew they paid more. So I started pushing all my intention towards how do I get those parks, and I kind of tailored my act. I was one of the first to start bringing my own lighting in with me, because in those days there weren't any moving lights, particularly in the venues. I mean, the odd few had a few, and I bought some Martin Pro 218s, these robo scans. And a truss, and I used to tour those with me. And people used to describe it as he brings a laser show with him, which of course it isn't, but that's how they perceived it, these moving beams, because that was kind of a new thing, the idea of haze and lights that could be programmed to go with the music was really quite devastating in those days. I remember when the lights used to go down at the start of the act, and I kind of had a little light show for a minute that opened the show. You could hear people were audibly impressed by it. And that was when I was starting to get into using some tech, you know, and I started using a television set around that time, as one of the things, and I became the guy with the TV, and I started trying to find other ways of not just doing just illusions. I tried to find some production to it without doing the same things, because I was already at that point in my life, I already worked out that, hey, there's about 7 or 8 illusion acts on the circuit, and if I were to list everything that they all do, I probably wouldn't get to 7 illusions before I've, like, everybody had the same kind of act.
Yeah,
you know, it was and that was okay, because there was no YouTube and people were seeing it for the first time, but I wasn't thinking about them. I was thinking about the bookers, you know, how do I differentiate myself from them, because everybody had a cube zag, everybody had a sub trunk, everybody had these standard things, and a few origamis, a couple of rich guys with an impaled back in those days.
Yeah, it's so true. And I suppose, you know, if you could give anybody advice that's watching this, that's something that you did very early on, which is probably part of your success, which is differentiating yourself from everyone else. How can somebody these days do that?
I would actually argue that I was trying too hard to be ahead of my time, and I never really reaped the benefits of a lot of them, because I always trying to evolve to what I thought people were going to want next. And I've not always been successful. I don't want to sound like I was some sort of guru, like I knew. I didn't know. I just felt that I felt very early on that the boy-girl illusion act dynamic was already feeling dated. The moment that chat show hosts were taking the mick out of it, or it was the butt of a joke, I'm like, well, it's already running to the end of its course. We need to find another way of presenting this. So I started doing the illusions by myself. I got a modern art and I adapted it so that I could kind of get in it myself. I had a mirror penetration. I didn't use the girl. And then I did I got the television set and I did that, and I started to become the tech. And then a few years later, I started doing the thing which I think most people think of me about is close-up magic on camera. Because I think if I popularized anything in this, I think I popularized that as an art form of using cameras for close-up. I mean, people were doing it, but I kind of worked it out, really. I mean, we saw Copperfield doing it. It wasn't my idea, certainly. So Doug Henning doing it on his specials, projecting it to screens, but those screens were so incredibly expensive and so bigger, and I kind of worked out how to do it on a smaller scale and how to start to fit it into the venues and what the kit was and how to kind of direct myself to do it. And that was really a big turning point for me, because it enabled me to tour all over the world easily and with a big show. And I work most of my life, I'm thinking as much about the tricks as I am the production value. Like, well, what's the music that goes underneath it? How can we change the lighting for that? How can we create that ambience and that depth of feeling? And I started to, I'm a big fan of musical theater, and I always felt, well, those shows move you to a different place, and magic can't do that. Copperfield is the closest I always felt to being able to move an audience through magic by telling a story. And I started to look a lot at script writing and thinking, how can I get a narrative arc into what I'm doing without it getting arty-farty, without ramming it down people's throats? How can I have there be some kind of meaning to a show? You know, how can people that come away take something with them? And I realized that people started to like to learn at a show. They didn't want to just be amazed. They loved picking up facts that they could take away. And I was an early viewer of TED Talks, and I started to think, that's kind of like how part of iMagician came about. Is there sections of iMagician that are very much like that? You know, you feel like you're being educated on something, then you see something wondrous. And then with luck, we tie a few of those things together to tie up some loose ends and give ourselves some kind of a point or some sort of uplifting feeling.
That's great. And you are right. You know, that you were right at the forefront when it came to tech magic and projecting stuff onto a screen. I remember many years ago now, through RSVP, you bought out that set of DVDs that basically, was it Pax? Massive, or it was a double.
I think these are like the last four in existence, I think.
That's it. Pax Paul Plays Massive. Yeah. I love those at the
They're
time.
They're unopened. I've never watched them.
Well, I watched them and I thought they were amazing and I learned so much. What was your reasoning behind bringing those out? Because you had something very, very unique that very few people were doing. And by bringing out those DVDs, you were giving people a blueprint to, hey, you
Well, they were starting to do it anyway. That was the thing. I mean, people, you know, it started a trend. It was nothing that I couldn't kind of protect it in any way. It was not, I mean, wouldn't it be great if I could say I'm the only one that's doing this and I don't want anybody else to do it so I can reap all the benefit of it as a business model? Wouldn't that be great? But you can't do that. You get things to yourself anyway, naturally, for a while, because it takes a while for word to spread. But, you know, there was, you know, I was the person that worked out that cartoon would translate into a bigger market. And I did that. And when I started doing that on ships, when nobody was doing cameras and I had this one effect and I'd worked how to frame it and I wasn't just doing it, I'd worked out how to present it correctly, it was absolutely bringing the house down when I started doing it. And it doesn't take long for technicians to tell other performers, oh, he does this, oh, it kills. And then it's not long before people start to just do it anyway. It's not my trick, so there's not much I could do to stop that. So I spoke to Russ, and I was already starting to develop the iMagician show. When I did those videos, I already have the title. And I said, I need to kind of burn the old act, really. If I give it away, then I'm forcing myself that I have to create new stuff. And I wanted to create, and for a while, my model was to try and stop people copying, was that the routines either had to be A, so ludicrously technical that people just wouldn't have the ability to or the time to do it, or prohibitively expensive so that it wasn't easily copied, which is a really bad model to go into. But I was like, this was something that would give me some degree of protection of these things. And I thought, if you had either the money or the ability to copy them, you probably also had the nonce to come up with something yourself.
Yeah.
Or the respect to ask if you can do it. So I stopped going for things that were easy if I was going to create something, for the most part. That's not true of everything. Sometimes the simplest idea is the best and you do them. But I haven't really had a big problem in recent years. It used to bother me. It doesn't really bother me as much now. It bothered me when I hadn't got any kind of name or recognition for it. And if I did something and I worked it up and then somebody else did it on a bigger platform and got a lot of recognition for it, that could be kind of frustrating. And that goes on, and my heart goes out to people when that happens to them. It happens too much in our industry. And I always feel like Teller says, if you've kind of dug a trick out and you've worked it out, you know, if it's from the past, that should be yours, you know, that, and I've never really understood the mindset of, you know, we all see it. Something comes on, America's Got Talent, or somebody does a trick and it kills. The next day, if you go on any of the Facebook groups, there's people saying, where can I buy this trick? I'm looking to buy this. And I just think that's the last thing I'd want to do is do something that's just been out there. Like, I've never really got it. It's like a tribute act that kills. Like, I don't know why somebody I don't understand what they're getting from it.
Yeah. Yeah. Totally agree. And that's what you've done. You've created so many unique pieces that are completely unique to you, which is why you are where you are.
Well, that's very kind of you. I mean, and they don't always work. I mean, that's the main thing is, I mean, there's, for everything that has worked, there's like two or three ideas that are just, we've burned so much money on stuff that just never pays off. You know, we spent fortunes working out this trick with cell phones, and we only did it twice. It was so complicated, and it just never panned out. And I tend to be attracted to things, as I was saying earlier, that are complicated, like complex methods or things that were layered. I was thinking of designing for TV and stuff at that time. So something that couldn't be, if you retrace the steps, you couldn't really find the answer because there was the methods were so layered, requiring a small army of people to do something that seemed, you know, I mean, this thing with the phones, I talk about it in my book. You know, we had, you know, we had like 12 people on three continents in real time making it work. It was ludicrous. You know, I don't know. I could have just done a torn and restored newspaper, would have killed.
Yeah, but it's that level of innovation that sets you apart from other people. It's that having that ability to take risks and kind of go, you know what? I'm gonna do this. It might not work, it might work. Because if you'd never taken a risk, if you'd never done that, then you wouldn't be where you are now. A lot of the stuff that did work wouldn't have even been in your act because you would never.
There are a few of those things. And I mean, not many of them, most of them I've never put out on YouTube. I really didn't need the recognition that much. So I've kind of kept the stuff that's in the live show that is original. We kind of keep it away from it now. There's no reason to put it out there when really the only people that are watching it on there are magicians. So I try and keep it for the show. But, I've gone full circle. I mean, I'm now in, you know, doing a show where I do, there's plenty of things that I do that are dealer bought items that we give our own spin on. There's plenty of things in the show that are not mine. And I enjoy just working out the presentation for them. And we pepper those with our own stuff. I don't want to come across as if I've just created all of this original material. I've created a few things. I mean, for me, the big thing was digital art, the iPads trick. That was the turning point for me. I think if you could probably, anybody that, what you perceive as success, I mean, if you perceive that I've been successful, I think that I have, that's just a perception. I don't feel that way. I'm still just working at it. But there was a definite change in the wind when I came up with digital art, because that was the gift that kept giving, because I did that on, what, 7 different TV shows? And that was the thing that really got me out of where I was, which was a cruise ship magician, into the touring world.
Well, I was going to actually ask that, because, you know, we got to the point in your career where you were touring holiday parks, but obviously we know from that you ended up touring cruises and going literally all over the world with your acts. But then at some point, you then transitioned into I'm a magician.
I'm a magician, yeah. Yeah.
What made you decide to go to that, and what steps did you go through?
Well, just to put it in a nutshell, I started off on cruise ships with a big illusion act. I had my like appearing helicopter and things on there. And then when I then transitioned that slowly over time down to an act that was more based around camera with some illusions. And then I stopped using the girl at that time, and I was just doing it myself, just with the camera. And then I started adding the tech tricks back in. And at that point, I realized I had enough just about to start to, I had this idea for iMagician. And then I met a guy, Joe Wenborn, who changed everything for me. He was the one who put the first money into it to put it out on tour and got it booked. And we tried it with 13 theatres, and we got the one show with the iPads, and that really helped sell. And we did actually quite well that first tour. It was okay. And we did that another 2 times The second year we went bigger, broke even. The third year we lost a little bit of money because we did too many dates and we were all over the place. And that was when I also realized that the UK is not the best place to tour a larger magic show, because I don't think there are many that actually really make much money on that, because it's a tough market in the UK for theatre. There's not to say they're all failing. They're not, but they're tough. You know, I know the Illusionists won't do it again.
Oh, really?
Well, they said they wouldn't do it back then when they toured. And that's a different thing from going into London, you understand. Like, if you go into London for a run, that's an entirely different beast. But touring the provinces, it's hard with magic. It's always hard to get people to come out and pay for a ticket. So we toured there, and then I said we want to get into the States. And we had a failed attempt to get into Las Vegas over a few years. We almost got there. You know, I had a theatre booked at the Venetian Hotel, the Sands Showroom. We had it all contracted. And then there was a slight clause in the contract that had to change. That clause meant that we didn't have the option to automatically re-up the venue if we did certain business. And as a result of that, it meant that one of the investors was not really happy with that, because in Las Vegas, there's no way you're going to make your money in the first 6 months, a year. It's a 5-year plan. You know, it's going to take that long to build an audience. So if we couldn't guarantee that we could keep the venue, then we were just going to lose money. So we didn't get that. And then I got another deal to have another showroom there, which I'm glad this one didn't happen, actually. But we were going to do it because we were just licking our wounds from just losing this other one. And I got offered this showroom at the Planet Hollywood that had been dark, and then Chris Angel wanted it, so they gave it to him, which was of course the right move. But but right before Chris Angel was announced, I actually had the deal on that showroom.
Oh wow!
But I'm glad, because we would have failed there, you know, where Chris had the following to be able to do it. Nothing like that. But we worked out a way to curtain the room down so that we could get the capacity down, and we had a good deal because they didn't know what to do with the room at that point. And obviously, if I was them, I would have said exactly the same thing. Like, yeah, of course they have to go that way. But we lost another one, and that's when I said, oh, you know, I've not really any desire to go to Vegas anymore. Then we concentrated on touring, doing more work in the US, and that's been very good for us, actually. And that was really where, although there are things I think that people might perceive as successful, the only times it's really worked is when we've worked in the US in the cities. That's
a lot of acts have tried to crack the US and they've been unable to, and you've actually made that happen. And not, you know, there are acts that have made it over there, but it's been part of an ensemble cast, and it's like, hey, we're gonna have this person and this person and this person. But you've gone over as yourself and been very successful over in America. I mean,
People have told me I'm the first British illusionist to ever do that. I don't know if that's true. I can't believe it is.
I can't think of anyone else.
Well, I mean, I always think of Piff, who's been remarkably successful, and he's not an illusionist, but remarkably successful. So by every measure of a magician, I imagine he's probably the most successful. But yeah, I mean, there are things I still want to do in the States, and the Americans like me. But this is where I was lucky to work American cruise ships for a decade, because I'd worked out how to play to Americans, and I love working to Americans. They're my favorite audience. They're so giving, and they love the magic. But it's not that easy. People think, oh, they're an easy crowd. They're not an easy crowd at all. Not at all. But you need to understand them and what they want. And just because people like something, it doesn't mean they like crap, you know.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Absolutely. But did you ever think at any point, you know what, I'm going to move to America?
Because you're there. Yeah, many times. I probably would have gone. It's my children that keep me in the UK. So we go and tour over there, and we come back. But you know, maybe one day. You know, I never rule out anything. We never rule out anything. You know, Nat and I, when we talk about it, we just say we don't know exactly what the future holds. So you know, we certainly have it's certainly an option to us if we wanted to do it. I mean, you know, we'll see what the future holds. I kind of like the uncertainty of life. I kind of like that. I don't really know what's going to happen. I like to know what's going to happen for approximately the next year, but it kind of depressing, isn't it, to know what's going to happen the year after, like it's all set. It's exciting not knowing.
It is. It absolutely is. And you said at the beginning of the interview, you're now transitioning away from iMagician and you're moving to another show. What was the reasoning behind that? Because obviously iMagician as a brand is very successful. You've toured many, many times. A lot of people have recognition of that name immediately.
Well, it won't be the end of it. It's we are bringing a new show specifically into Chicago.
Okay.
Because we are touring in the US from the start of November. For the first 2.5 weeks, we are doing a few venues and then a little sit down in St. Louis. And then after we've done that, we are going to Chicago for 7 weeks. So we have a theater for November 24. We're going to open. We're going to close January 7th. So we're there for the whole period. And because I've been in Chicago with iMagician, and because I've taken my immersive magic show, Magic Immersive, the Child of Illusionarium, it has gone into Chicago. I need a new name. So we needed a new show, and we had new material that we hadn't used before. So we are transitioning it, but this show is more of a stopgap. It's not actually, like, there are things that I've done before in it. It's not a totally new show. There's a lot of new material in there, and we're working very hard on it still now. And we'll probably still be tweaking and writing it until the night before, because that's how these things roll. But you know, I mean, I know what the show is now, but who's to say if that's exactly what's going to go on stage? You know, I woke up with an idea middle of the night before last, and I phoned up Tommy, my right-hand guy, and I said, I've got this idea. And he's like, that's brilliant. Okay, so that's upset the apple cart. So we've got to change everything to do this. But yeah, the actual new show for me will be next year, which is the 63rd minute. That's a show that we've been working on with Tommy and Harry DeCruz for a couple of years now. And that will be the show which is a real change in direction for me. It's much more art based.
Okay.
And that's something we're really looking forward to doing. That's going to be a very different show to what we've done before. The new show is just called Amaze, my new show. But that's not just a magic title. There is actually meaning to that in the show. Yeah.
Well, when you're working new material in, I mean, obviously you're doing it on a very big scale, but do you have any advice? Because the reason I ask this is I get questions on this channel all the time, and one of the big questions I get is from people that are working pros. They don't necessarily tour, but they gig, and that they have a new thing that they have worked on. Maybe it's original to them, maybe it's a variation of a dealer item, and they desperately want to put it into their show, but when they go to they put it into their thing, they go to the venue, and then they don't put it in because they're like, well, you know, it's going to be a stressful situation. And it ends up staying in their box for like 6 months. And then ends up going.
It's like the same as the prototype that we make to make the trick work. That's still the same thing a decade later, all held together with tape. There's no advice other than there's never a good time. You have to just try it. I mean, obviously, my style, I'm quite lucky because I'll quite openly tell the audience, hey, I'm working on a new thing which I'd like to show you, and you'll be the first ever audience to see it. And sometimes I might say that for the first 5 or 6 shows, but I just tell them, and I put it at the right time in the show. But I'm quite honest with the audience, and I've always felt that's worked for me. I just talk to them, and they're very happy to, if they feel they're in a real conversation with you and you're not just standing on stage going through this motion, the audience are really excited the idea that you're going to do something that's brand new. They love it. They feel like they're in a special moment. The moment you tell the audience that, they're all kind of like heightened awareness. They love it. They love it for the same reason they react so well when something they perceive has gone wrong, as is a plot that we use so much. You know, they feel like, wow, that happened tonight. You know, we've all had that moment when an audience member's come up to you years later saying, hey, I saw your show the night when, and proceed to describe something that always happens. Mm-hmm. And I think that I've no advice other than, you know, put it in the position in the show when you can recover from it. Like, don't put it in the final three. And then don't, you know, and maybe be honest with the audience. That's what I do. Just tell them I'd like to try something, and I don't put too much meat on it, and I don't put too much pressure on myself with it either. You also have to get yourself to a point of view where you're not too bothered if it doesn't work. Mm-hmm. It's not the end of the world, you know. It's only a magic show. They don't get too stressed about it. There's a show would have to go exceptionally badly to stop you from working ever again. Like, can you imagine what would have to happen?
Oh my gosh, yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
No, that's very true. That's great. So that kind of brings us up to date. And then we know that at Blackpool 2023, you launched your book, Everything. And we're going to be having a separate chat about this in a while, but I'd like to touch on it right now if I could.
Yeah, absolutely.
Incredible. I've had it since Blackpool. It's absolutely incredible. What made you decide to put that together? Because that must have took a long time. And without being funny, you're a busy guy. You've got family, you tour all over the world, you're constantly developing something new, as well as, you know, taking other bookings outside of touring.
Yeah, I started writing notes for it in COVID, and then I was finding in the schedule that I had times when I'm working away, when there are days that I'm not doing anything, and I just started writing it. But I didn't write that book as a money-making exercise. I wrote it because I wanted to write it, because nobody else was going to, and I just wanted to put it. I just wanted to put, what happened to me down so that my kids could have it. I felt that I'd done enough when I launched, when I did Illusionarium in the pandemic in Toronto, and then Magic Immersive in Chicago, those big immersive shows. Those experiences were so rich for me that I felt that I think I finally have a story to tell now. So although the book has, you know, 13 illusions and a bunch of stage magic, it really has the blueprints for how I've done the things that I've been able to. And I do think at this point now I've made enough mistakes that I was able to pass on some knowledge that I think if anybody has ever been remotely interested in trying to sell a ticket to a show, I wanted it to be a book for them.
Yeah, which a lot of people, that's their big goal in life. You know, I'd like to tour. I'd like to have my own touring show. And that's something that you've done over and over again over the last many, many years. And the fact
and it doesn't always work. You know, you make money, you lose money, and you can't go into those things to make the money. You've got to get into it because you really want to do it, and you see no other road to you. You have to do it. And then if you're that kind of person, then I wanted to write about that because I think there's precious little on that subject, really, particularly from our point of view of how do you sell and market a magic show, and how do you make the costs work, and how do you produce it, and how do you tour it, and what are the logistics like for that? Like, how does it work day to day, and how do you bankroll it? How did I raise the money to do it? That kind of thing.
Which is, you're right. I don't think anybody else has ever spoken about that subject at all.
I'm sure they have, but I'd like to think that it's relevant today, and I think it'll be relevant. I've tried to write things that I think will be relevant in 50 years, frankly, because certain things don't change. There's plenty of times in the book I've had to reference, this is how it is right now, and I'm sure that this will evolve, but the fundamental rule will be the same.
Yeah.
I think. I won't be around in 100 years to find out if I'm right or not, so
And did you've talked about how you've been on TV an awful lot, and that's helped your career. You talked about the first time that you were on the one show, and that helped sell tickets. As America is such a big audience for you, have you ever considered going on like somewhere like America's Got Talent and having that showcase?
Yeah, I have no interest anymore in doing one of those shows because I think that they are brilliant, and I think they give a real bump to a career. But I'm no longer convinced that they would. I think the best that would happen for me is I would win my own job. You know, I think I'm kind of doing it. What I'd want to get from it. And I'm not sure that. I think it's a fantastic vehicle for people that need that exposure bump and that lift to try and get them into a better position than they are now. But I kind of had done enough TV that it gave me. Somebody once gave me the advice to build slowly, you know, to build the foundations And to say, you know, building it one brick at a time over a long period of time, just always doing good work, TV, radio, newspapers, good work, just slowly just keep putting these bricks in this wall until I've slowly built a career out of it. And it's more solid, those foundations, because I'm building them brick by brick rather than having a sudden hit that goes away. You know, we all see our friends that have had success on those shows, and then a year later we're reliving it, saying, hey, remember this last year when my life changed? Or remember, you know, and it's like, it's a lot psychologically to deal with, isn't it? You go on that show, you get all this exposure, then it kind of just drops away. And yeah. you and there are people that have come out that have done exceptionally well, you know, people like Ben Hart that I think found an audience out of that, you know, found a niche audience. And that would be my advice to people going on those shows, is try and work out who is your audience and try and play to them. Don't go on it to win the show. Try and find out who is it that, what makes you different, and who is your crowd, and therefore who is going to pay to come and see you. You know, there's a great quote I heard recently. What was it? The guy, what's the guy's name? Harrison Greenbaum said it at Magic Live about being sushi. You know, you want to be sushi because some people hate sushi, they can't bear it, but the people that love sushi, they'll go out of their way to eat it. They'll go there on special occasions. They'll go there. If you could be sushi rather than a burger, then, you know, that's what you want. You don't want everybody to like you. You want the people that do like you to love you. I think there's definitely some truth in that. I'm kind of general, honestly. Because my appeal is mass marketer. I don't know if that's the right thing, but I mean, we're touring theatres and we are appealing to, we're casting a wide net. And when I look into our audience, you know, we've got date nights, you know, we've got young families, we've got retired couples, we've got everybody in between in there. So magic is quite cross-generational, I think. It seems to appeal to everybody.
Absolutely.
But yeah, that would be my advice. And no, that was a long answer to your question, wasn't it, Craig? Got talent? And the short answer would be not really.
Mm, I totally understand. I want to ask you one more question before we switch subjects slightly. And this is a question I've had from many people on my channel. And I think that if there's anybody that could answer this, it's you. How, one thing that I can see that you're very good at is time management. You can't get as much done as
not everybody would agree with you on that, Craig, if you were in my household.
From the outside looking in, how do you balance, this is a question I get all the time, how do you balance your work life and your family life? Because I know that family is very important to you, but I also know that you're touring and you have to spend time, you're working with teams. But like, how?
Well, I mean, you have to have great people around you. I mean, my partner Nat, she's fantastic, and she makes sure that I do what I need to get done, and she's very aware that I have things that need to be done, and she checks in on me to make sure that allowed the time to be able to do it, because I mean I work from home, and there are times that it gets crazy busy, and she's brilliant at helping me with that, and I have great people, you know. Mm. I have great people around me that I work with. It's not a one-man show. It might be my name on the poster, but that's far from it. I mean, it's a business, and none of it would work without, you know, Nat and without Tommy, my right hand. And we've got Steve in the States and Joe Wenborn in the UK. And we've got Claire Nordbrook, who does all of our graphic and does virtually everything in between for us. And, you know, our small team, I think it's about finding people that are good at what they do. My dad used to say that to me, you know, surround yourself with people that are better than you at what they do. Like, find the best people. Don't try and be a one-man band. It's so common in magic to... and we have to be this way. We have to be your own marketing manager, your own salesperson. You have to. And hopefully, eventually, you get some help with that if you're successful. But that doesn't mean to say you should. Like, if you can get a friend even to want to watch your show, if you can't afford a director, you know, have those people help you. That helps with your time. You know, after we finish speaking today, I'm on probably a 3-hour call, which is, you know, going to be, you know, with our magic consultant. and that, you know, and I just try to put it in blocks if I can. Last night, well, you know, but yesterday was a busy day. So when you say I'm good with the time management, I sort of think I didn't sleep much last night because I've got a lot going through my head right now, because at this exact moment, we are dealing with all the marketing for several venues, and you know, we're dealing with the logistics for that, which is, you know, the trucking and the accom and the flights, and that's all getting booked, and we're dealing with the show, and we're transitioning to this new show. And yes, last night in the middle of the night, I'm waking up going, oh god, what am I, you know, what have I missed, you know, what haven't we done? So I set office hours. That would be the best answer. I try to set myself time that I'm going to work from here to here. But if I sit down and there's nothing to do, then I stop.
Yeah.
Make myself do something.
And before we finish, I want to talk about one other venture and maybe just touch on this. Because at Blackpool 2023, as well as having the book Everything, you also launched a new innovative sound lab app, you know, that you're doing with who I consider to be one of the best developers in magic, Joshua Riley, and that's been taking the world by storm as well. I mean, we just talked about how busy you are, and then it's like, well, you know what, I'm going to set up another business, why not?
Right, so I did that to solve a problem that I was just like, why wasn't it? So it's Adam Heppenstall and I decided to start it. Adam's an incredible craftsman, great thinker. I've had a long-term relationship with Adam, great friend of mine, great craftsman. We decided I was always getting asked about building a close-up table for magicians with the camera rig, and so Adam and I set about to design one that was like the ones we were using, but refined, so as an actual product rather than the things that we put together for ourselves, make it like as good as it could be. And along the way, we said we should really develop an app to make the camera work for this from your phone. It would just be so much better. And that's what we did. We brought in Joshua. We formed a business called IQ Pro, which is like QLab, but it's on your iPhone. And in many ways, QLab is extremely good. It's also very expensive. But what you really need, because the phones are so good on an iPhone, the cameras are so good on an iPhone, I said, wouldn't it be great if you could get all your video playing from your iPhone, your audio playing from your iPhone, use the camera in your iPhone over the table, and just plug in an HDMI cable that sends the sound and the video on the cruise ship or the club or the theatre you're in to the screen and to the speakers. Because in that way, you could just have your phone with you, or a phone. And we use these flick buttons, these long range flick buttons that are incredible. I don't have one next to me, that are incredible. And because they operate on this long range Bluetooth, which is unlike your grandfather's Bluetooth that used to break down, like long range Bluetooth with flick is unbelievably powerful. You can operate this thing outside the theater. It's tiny little coin buttons. And now we've got this incredible app that runs, you know, that can do all of these incredible things that QLab can't do, like dynamic zooms. You know, it can zoom around and follow your action on the table. It can, it brings up all your graphics, allows you to create graphics. You can create slides, lower thirds in there with it. It does all of your audio, all your fades in, fades out. We're about to release our update with DMX Lighting, which has up to 8,000 fixture library for universes of DMX. Again, all can be controlled wirelessly from your phone. So you can control all your moving lights. You don't need to control any of those things. Like, you can, if you just want to play a bit of sound for your show, it's the, if you want to play a bit of video in your show or a pre-show or have a background running, or if you want to do a close-up trick, you've got the entire thing on your iPhone. And it's the best system in the world for it right now, because it's more cost effective than any competitor, and it does more than any competitor for a performer. I'm not saying it's QLab, because QLab is a different beast, but QLab requires a high-end Mac, requires a lot of peripherals, requires a very expensive license, and it's fantastic, but it's more than most of us need as a performer. We need to be able to control our sound cues, our audio cues. We need to be able to control our video. We might want to use a live camera. And we've got some fantastic features in between. Oh, you can add your name in 3D and move it around, add it to a background. We have a library of content that you can access. And it's the best in the world, and it's cheaper than everything. You know, because it only, you know, but when we do a sale on it, it's like it costs about two thirds of the nearest competitor, you know. So it's a phenomenal product, and I'm really, really proud of Joshua and Adam. They've worked so hard with it, and we've got some really exciting updates that I know, you know, what's coming down the pipeline with it. And you know, we're really excited to share those with people. And it's built a nice little following, actually. We could do with more, you know. We could do with more. It's a we're still building the business, we're still building our army, but we've got a lot of great people. Right now, there's a lot of great people out there that are using it, you know, you know, nightly. Pete Furman's using it at the moment on his tour, you know, Paul Zerdin. You know, we've got a bunch of the people that are on there, like Tom Crosby is using it constantly, Tom Wright. I mean, and the list goes on and on. Michael Fitch used it the other night, the Magic Circle. They've started using it to run the stuff for the show, for the Kavari show. They're using IQ Pro. It's just simple. It's simple to use, and it's intuitive. You can kind of work it out, but it's incredibly powerful, but it's only as powerful as you need it to be.
Mm.
Yeah.
Fantastic. And like you say, you just launched it at Blackpool this year. So, I mean, it's only been around for 6 months and it's already being used by so many people.
Yeah, it's been wonderful. The pickup for it worldwide has just been delightful. It's been wonderful to deal with, and Joshua's a genius. You know, he's great at it, because me and Adam know what it needs to do. That's how our relationship works, because we've worked with Show Control for so long that we know everything that it needs to be able to do. But you know, Joshua makes it work. I don't know how any of it works. It's like magic, Craig. I don't know how it works. But it does.
I've had that experience with Joshua many times. Yeah. He'll just show me something and I'm like, how would you even consider thinking of this?
Yeah,
he's a really good guy. Really good guy. So let me ask you one more question, Jamie, because I know you're busy. I want to ask you one more question, which is, and this goes back to what I said at the very beginning of the interview. What's next? And what I mean by that, like I said, if we took a snapshot of where you are right now, most performers worldwide would be happy ending their career at the point that you're at right now. But during the course of this interview, you've talked about shows that you're just about to embark on. You've talked about a new show that's coming next year that you're working on. You've talked about where you're taking IQ Pro. You've talked about so many different things. Like, is there anything left on your magical bucket list that you want to hit? What are your goals over the next few years? And is there can you foresee a time where you kind of go?
There's one thing that's that is sitting out there that I haven't done. That, I mean, I'll just say it here, that I will do, is I want to play Broadway. And I will play Broadway at some point. That would be the next major thing for me. That would be something that I would go, well, if I got to do that, but equally, if that doesn't happen, but that's what I'd like to do. I might do the West End at some point, though. It's funny that because I live so close to London, it doesn't hold the allure for me that Broadway would. But we'd like to build on our touring market in the US. Up until now, we've done more sort of sit-down experiences where we've gone into a place for 1 month, and that's been good for us, but we would like to tour. So we're just dipping our toe in the water in November and doing a few theatres more than we normally do, just to see how that feels for us, and what it's like going into those venues night after night. So that's going to be a new experience for us. We're doing that on a slightly smaller scale at first as well, just so that we can manage it, because I've made that mistake before where we booked too many and we lost control of it. So we're doing three theatres in a row. Then we're doing one theatre for six performances before we go to Chicago. And it's going to be enough for us, because we're already booking tour dates in the US. We've already got some next August. So we're kind of a lot far out, but that's where we're looking to build the more substantial next tour. But we're kind of going out to learn in November, a little under the radar, really. And then we're gonna go into Chicago and we'll do the best we can there. Different show in Chicago, because last time I was in Chicago, we did the Harris Theatre, For 2 weeks, as many, many performances, multiple performances a day, sometimes as many as three a day in this theatre that was 1,550 seats. And it was the best experience of my life because we did such great business there. We did about, I think, like 85, 90% capacity average business over the run, which was just remarkable. And I think it was the highest selling magic show that Chicago's ever had. And we, and because of that, we got a lot of press. And this show this year, I'm so excited. We're going in for 7 weeks, so many more shows than I've ever done in one location. So it's going to be in the realm of, you know, 50 to 60 performances, more so. But we're going into a much smaller theatre that actually caps out at like 240. And it's going to be a much more intimate show, tiny little balcony, beautiful, like a theatre that shrunk down. And I'm so excited to do this new show that's going to be much more intimate and more immersive because of it. You know, the ticket price is a fraction higher, the average ticket price fraction higher because of that, but because it's a smaller show with that smaller crew and everything, we can afford to do it that way, and it still actually works out for us really well. So I'm hoping that that's a success, because that's something I've been really passionate about for a while.
That's amazing. That's wow.
But who knows? You know what I mean? I'm okay. Like, I've done enough in my life. I'm happy with what I've done. And I'm also, I don't really have much anything in the way of ego, really. I just have a desire to want to do it. And it might all go terribly wrong. There's still time.
Yeah, but, you know, it's what we spoke about earlier, you know, taking risks. You've got to do that. You know, you've got to do that if you want to get to where you're at.
Yeah, well, if you're only here once, aren't we? And we have to. Well, that's what I believe, anyway. We're only here once, and I'd rather fail and try. That's how I've always been.
Yeah,
I'd rather try.
And I look back and go, well, I gave it 100% than I wish I had.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. Mm. We did the best we could. That's all we can ever do, isn't it?
Absolutely. Yeah. And, you know, you mentioned earlier on about Vegas. Is that something that you'd still like to try and push towards, or is that kind of itch being scratched and you're moving in different directions now?
I can tell you that when I was in Vegas, I was offered a showroom, a good showroom in a good theater, and I haven't thought much about it since.
So well, that's
probably it. I don't think so. I never say never. You never know. I at the moment, I don't think so right now. And I'm also worried about the market in Las Vegas at the moment. I mean, people are not, it's not breezy out there right now. It's not as easy to sell tickets in Vegas as it once was. And there's too many shows out there, and it's hard to make money in Las Vegas, really hard. Vegas is my favorite place on earth. Mm. I absolutely love it. So why wouldn't I want to work there? But also, the crowds in Vegas are not like your theatre crowds the rest of the places. You know what the crowds there are like. They've kind of just wandered in that day. It's a little, you know, I think we as magicians are more attracted to it. I think I was certainly attracted to it because of its history. David Copperfield, you know, Penn and Teller, Siegfried and Roy, the greats, Lance Burton, were always there. Now it's different. And I don't know what Vegas will look like when Copperfield and Penn and Teller are no longer there.
And that day is coming at some point soon. It's, I don't know when, but it's not.
Yeah, I know. I mean, I'm a huge fan, you know, obviously. And when I worked on Illusionarium, and I got to work with David Copperfield, and that was like a dream come true for me. And also, you know, Penn and Teller, and I talked to Penn a bit now, and those guys are fantastic. I mean, I got a most wonderful day when I was doing Magic Immersive in Chicago, my show there, and Penn flew out to do a lot of press with me, and we were going around all day in a car these various radio stations and TV stations, and that was, what a hell of a day. And I was looking back going, wow, what would little me have thought about this is awesome, just laughing and shooting the breeze with these people. I'm just fantastic, and very down to earth. And I found that, you know, people like that, my heroes, like, you know, and on some level friend, maybe, or friendly, you know, these people that I've respected so much, they are, you know, they say you never meet your heroes, and I certainly haven't been disappointed. They've all been absolutely wonderful, and That's a, you know, that's something else that's my, that, that my career has given to me, is the, you know, mixing with these wonderful, fascinating people that I just could never have dreamed of, you know, even as much as a decade ago. That's... It's all come around in a decade for me, Craig. Everything, a decade ago was when I first started touring Eye Magician. Everything is in the last 10 years. When I was, I'm just 45, so 35 when I started that. And I started kind of getting into it late, but I was trying to build a foundation, and it's all in the last 10 years.
I mean, that's...
I just hope the next 10 years aren't boring.
Well, I mean, yeah, but even up until, you know, 10 years ago, you'd still achieved so much. You know, there's some people, and they're sitting here watching this, and they're thinking, you know, my goal would be to be able to travel the world on a cruise ship.
I get those messages all the time. It's a phenomenal job, and I still do it, by the way. You know, I still work for, I only work for Royal Caribbean, but I mean, when I'm not working, I will nip on. We're going on Royal Caribbean tomorrow. Nat and Nevada and I, we're going on the Anthem of the Seas. Wonderful. We're going there for, you know, 4 nights. I'm going to do a show. The family's going to love it, and you know, we'll eat well. We get a nice suite on there. Royal Caribbean really look after me after all this time. They're just, it's lovely to be on those ships. And it's so great, big theatre, you know, and it's the, I love the shows on there. Royal Caribbean are phenomenal. They have, like, you know, the shows that they have are, you know, proper shows. They're not like cruise shippy at all. They're like the show the night before me is We Will Rock You. You know, that's an installed show on there. It's the official production, you know, official directors, everybody cast by the London, you know, company. It's all, you know, it's incredible. And then the next night it's me with my Pelican case.
That's amazing though. But it's great. It's great that you built up that relationship with them. They look after you so much.
And they're lovely. They're absolutely lovely. I can't say enough about them. And the cruise ships were great. But I mean, I just need diversity. I just get bored too easily, you know.
You know what? That's one thing that I've noticed about you, Jeremy. Obviously, you know, I've really enjoyed doing this interview because although I know of you and we chat, I don't know you very well. So I'm learning an awful lot through this interview. But one thing that I've always noticed is everybody I've spoken to, they always speak so highly of you. And a lot of the time when I interview people, it's like, oh, you're not interviewing that person. You're not interviewing that person, are you? You've never, like, as far as I can see, you've never burnt bridges. You've never left somebody with a side
note. There's definitely some people out there, because there's always those ones that the moment I post anything, you know, on YouTube, dislike. like the instant that they're there just to do it. So there's obviously must be some somebody, but not to my knowledge. I mean, I really hate confrontation like that. I don't really want to fall out with anybody, and I try not to, you know, get myself too involved in things that don't concern me. And I also try to, like, I get excited about what I do. There are times in my life that I've been worried that because I'm excited about something that I'm doing and I want to tell people, that it could come across as egotistical. And I certainly have never meant it in that way. It's just because I've just gotten excited about this new thing. I never had any desire to be famous when I was growing up. Like, I never chased trying to get onto the TV when I was young or anything like that. I wanted to perform, and my heart is always will always be with live theatre, and my want is to sell tickets. And unfortunately, I have to try and do some TV and other things in order for that to happen. I have to have done TV and a lot of press in order to get the visa that I require to work in America. Mm-hmm. All of these things just feed the other, you know. And no doubt we'll do a bunch of TV this year out in the States to promote the shows, but I've never particularly liked any of that stuff.
I can imagine. Well, Jamie, this has been an amazing interview. So first of all, people can buy the book if they like, and I'm going to do a separate review on this obviously very soon, but people can buy the book and find out more about it and read reviews from people like Penn and Teller, Penn Jillette and so on, Andy Nyman, so on and so forth.
Yeah.
You can go to Jamie.
Well, the Penn Jillette review probably doesn't have much weight right now, because I've just told you I know the guy, so they probably think, oh, it's just fed him. But But no, but I mean, yeah, people like, you can read the reviews of Andy Nyman and stuff, and people, and it's been reviewed multiple times. It's, the website's dead easy if you want to find it. It's Jamie Allen, if you can spell Allen, A-L-L-A-N, it's jamieallenbook.com.
And so, I'll put a link in the description down below.
Yeah.
And if people want to know more about your close-up tables and all the technology that you and Josh and have been working on, what website would they go to check that out?
Well, we would go to IQ Pro. You can go to IQ, so it's like the letters, iqpro.app, or iqproapp.com. I think we've got both. Or you can go to the App Store and just search for IQ Pro Show Control. You have to put IQ Pro, you have to put Show Control in sometimes, because there's a lot of things that are IQ tests, you know, that come up and you have to scroll otherwise to find it. But IQ Pro Show Control in the Apple App Store, is free trial. You can download it and have a look at it. We've got a great Facebook group called the, if you're looking for, look us up on Facebook, there's a users group, IQ Pro users, and you can join there. And we've got a great community of people that are helping each other out and, you know, offering advice on how they're doing it. And and IQ Pro will change the way you run your show. You know, people think they don't need it till they use it, and then they can't go back. It changes everything. Production value is everything.
Wow. Okay, that's amazing. And I have a big, a lot of people that watch this channel. I have more viewers for this channel in America than I do in the UK by far. So if people are over in America and they want to catch your tours over the next couple of years, or somebody's in Chicago and wants to watch your new show that's taking place over in November and December up until January the 7th, where would people go to find out all about your tour dates?
They could go onto imagicianlive.com. Imagicianlive.com will have the full listings of everywhere that we are. There are other new sites being set up for the new show, but everything will be on that site.
Amazing.
We actually, as we're speaking today, Craig, that show has not gone on sale. It will go on sale at the weekend, and it will all be announced, so it'll all fit together beautifully.
Absolutely, it will, because this is going on over the weekend, so this is synergy. That's amazing. Jamie,
in fact, Craig, you are actually the person announcing it. Here, that's it. We haven't told anybody, because what's the point in telling anybody till you're on sale? I'm like, people say, oh, I want to tell everybody, I'm excited. I'm like, don't tell anybody until they can buy a ticket.
Yeah,
that's one thing I've learned. There's a piece of advice.
That's a very good point. Yeah, a really good point. So go, anybody watching this, go buy a ticket if you're anywhere near any show that Jamie is doing. It is incredible. Also, go check out the book, look for a review on Magic TV soon. Go check out everything that Jamie's talked about. But honestly, I want to say one more time, I know how busy you are. I know how much you have going on. We've been trying to do this for a long while. So thank you so much for finding the time.
Thank you. Genuinely, I mean that. Thank you. It's really nice to sit and chat about this. I always feel a bit uncomfortable just talking about myself. You know, like it's a bit self-congratulatory, and I don't really, you know. I appreciate it very much, and if any of you have managed to watch this all the way through, like, well done.
I think a lot of people will have, and I know they will have had a great time. But I want everyone who's been watching this to leave a comment down below. Let Jamie know what you think. That would be amazing. Leave a comment down below, and I'm going to see you again very, very soon on this channel. But Jamie Allen, one more time, thank you so much.
Thank you, Craig.
No problem. Guys, I'll see you again soon. My name's Craig from Magic TV.
Thanks for listening to the Talk Magic Podcast.
Magic.
Be sure to like and subscribe to the Magic TV YouTube channel.
Magic TV.
Which includes 14 unique videos every week. Whatever type of magic you're interested in, we've got you covered. Just search YouTube for Craig Petty's Magic TV, or click on the link in the description from this podcast below. Be sure to join us next Friday at 5 p.m. right here for another Talk Magic Podcast.